You know, hey, you know what? People want to get a gun, whatever gun they want to get. I encourage that 100%. I just, at a certain point, I get the whole idea of buying performance, and I have no issues with that. If you want to shoot a gun, great. But I can't help but think that Legion is the new kid on the block, and everybody's all gaga about the new kid.
So, honestly, so I was talking to Clay. Clay wants to shoot carry optics, and he doesn't have a carry optics gun, so he had to buy something. And in my honest opinion, the X5 Legion might be the best. If it fits your hands, I think it probably is the best right now.
You think so?
What do you think is better than the Legion?
Objectively, I don't know. I really don't know. I have never shot a Legion. But I think it's very, I keep coming back to this argument that people keep making about how the plastic guns are so much better because they're light and they transition fast, but you lose the accuracy.
Honestly, that's such a, honestly, I think it's bullshit, because if that was the case, when I open guns transition super slow.
Well, I think it's BS too, but that's what everybody, that was the hill that everybody decided they want to die on. Yeah. And it's like, dudes, it's not that big of a thing. I mean, you can transition a heavy gun just as well as a light gun. It just takes, you know, you learning how to do it. And so,
yeah. Well, it just feels nicer. That's the point. The lighter gun always feels nicer when you do it.
Yep.
That's the thing.
I think
when you're actually moving around, it doesn't do much, but it feels nicer.
I think gun handling might feel a little better with a lighter gun. Like when I always shot my open gun, draws and reloads never felt that good because it was so heavy to throw around.
Mm-hmm.
But actually transitioning the gun target to target always felt fine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Man, I don't know. I was telling Clay that like if the X5 fits your hands, I think it's the best. For me, it doesn't fit my hands at all, so I'll stick with the Glock.
Well, it's one of the things that is pretty nice is that it's got most of the stuff you need out of the box.
Yeah.
Yeah,
you can get a really nice trigger out of them. They shoot good groups. They seem to be reliable.
You get 420 round mags. You get some adjustable sights if you want to play with it. Any other thing pops off the plate. Throw a Delta Point straight on it, and it'll be fine. Takes 1911 springs. Like, there's a lot of things that are good with the platform. It's, you know, but is it better than everything once it's all set up? Probably not. Like, that's the problem.
I think fundamentally it really comes down to kind of what you're saying, Kenny. It depends on what works for you. If it works for you, I mean, rock on. Because who is it? Marcus Blanchard. I mean, he's shooting an M&P, and he's obviously doing pretty good. Whereas, you know, you have Brett shooting an X5. Dave Blanton is shooting he's shooting a Glock. I know people who are destroying Shadow 2s. So, I mean, it's whatever floats your boat. I mean,
yeah.
It was funny. So this Colorado match, there was a guy from New Zealand. So he's normally shooting IPSC, and he was running a Shadow 2, but I can't remember what the dot was called now. It was all plastic, and the thing was tiny.
Really?
Oh. Yeah.
Huh.
Like all plastic. He said he didn't have to cut up his slide like you did, Rob.
Oh, wow.
To make weight. That's why he said he runs it, because it's so small.
Yeah, I think if I ever actually went back to shooting carry optics, no joke, I would shoot a Trijicon RMR because it was the most robust dot ever.
So you know people saying that like the Shadow 2, it's like the metal guns are destroying DOS faster. Do you think there's any validity to that?
I don't have enough data to prove that. I think there is an argument, however, to be made as to the adapter plate, because the adapter plate's made out of aluminum.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of people do seem to be having problems with that adapter plate shearing off.
Yeah.
And so that argument, I think there's some validity to that argument, but I'm not smart enough to know all the, what do you call it, metallurgical properties, stuff like that, that it's just so outside my wheelhouse. I can only speak anecdotally to my experiences and the people that I've seen.
Well, wouldn't your slide have to move just moving a lot faster to make it harder on the dot? I mean, I don't...
Well, maybe it'd have to be moving a lot faster, or maybe it's just the people who have a Shadow 2 sent out and milled and throw something on it also have the money to shoot more ammunition through them.
It could be.
Like, maybe it's just literally just going out there and shooting with it. Or maybe it's the frame. Maybe the frame doesn't flex as much on the back end as a metal gun, and so it's a little bit more jarring. But...
I remember back in the old days when 10 millimeter came out. I mean, this was like, you know, post 1986, the shootout and all that stuff, when the FBI,
yeah,
they came out with that, the metal frame gun. I can't remember what it was, like a Bren or something like that, but the problem, well,
they had the Bren 10, but they also had the Smith and Wesson 10 1006,
yeah,
which was their third generation Smith chambered in 10 millimeter.
And it was, but it was just, it was, the 10 millimeter was just beating the crap out and destroying the gun, the metal frame gun. And it was only when Glock came out with their, what was it, the Glock 20, I think it was, yeah, where it was this plastic gun that basically some of the energy was allowed to absorb through that plastic frame and then kind of recover. Yep. That they found success in the 10 millimeter platform. And so that's why the argument about, is the metal frame guns destroying dots, it kind of has some interest to me, because I'm wondering, I think of that, and then I'm wondering if that's what's happening potentially with metal frame guns. I just don't know.
Yeah, I'm curious if some people maybe got them undersprung as well, so it's just beating them up more.
Well, I know I run mine a lot heavier, because if you run the traditional springs that most people run for a production Shadow 2, that slide whips back fast enough that I can feel, like, my thumbs are high up and you can actually feel the brass hitting into my thumbs while it's being ejected out. And so I sprung it so that it would stop doing that, because surprisingly, it actually kind of hurt every time that brass would just whack into your thumbs like that.
Yeah. I know the Walkies are running 2 pounds lighter recoil spring on their Glocks than I am. And I'm curious, maybe that's played into why they've broken so many dots.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I know that the tech support that I got from Zane, I mean, he was suffering all sorts of slides being broken, or not slides, but sights being broken. And seeing the recoil spring that he had on his compared to what I put onto mine, I can understand how being undersprung would just batter a slide to pieces.
Yeah, something's got to take the abuse.
Yeah, for sure.
It makes you appreciate engineers actually, like, looking at spring rates and putting it into the gun. And so the gun would actually, the best spring package is probably the one that came from the factory as far as service life and making sure the thing ran forever.
Yeah.
I think what you would have to do this, or to at least before you even go into thinking about the metal frames, is you simply take a Glock 34, right? You get something that has, well, let's make the cycle rate a little bit lighter. Let's do like a Glock 17 MOS, put an 11-pound recoil spring in one, put a factory, keep everything stock on another one, and play around with that and see how long it takes for one of them to give out. Because, like, same ammunition, same everything else, but just see if that's going, and then maybe you try the same thing on a metal frame gun. The interesting thing about the SIG, especially the Legion, since it's tungsten infused, like, I wonder, like, under high speed, how that thing actually flexes.
Sure.
Like,
yeah.
How rigid is it? What does it do? What does it change? But we'll kind of see that. But, Kenny, you're in Colorado.
Yeah. All right, so the goal is, if I could leave Denver 5 or 6, make home, see the Utes game, whatnot. Well, I wake up in the morning, go outside, look at the car, start packing it, and realize my right rear tire's rim's on the ground. Oh, that's a fucking great way to start it out. So I'll get on Google Maps, start looking for tire shops. Nobody opens till fucking 8 a.m. in Denver. So I'll go sit in the hotel room till 7:30 or whatnot. So, you know, go and do that, and then I can't get my freaking tire off because Big O stripped out the lug nuts.
What?
And all, you know, I'm a mechanic, but it's not like I carry a tow tray everywhere I freaking go. So I'm like, oh, yeah, sweet, there's 7-Eleven just down the road. I guess I'm driving on a flat tail. So I get 7-Eleven, air it up, drive to Big O.
Do you not have a, oh, you couldn't get it off, so that you couldn't put the spare, so I go, of course.
Like, this is a long story. So I go Big O. Big O's like, yeah, we can't find a problem. Like, well, whatever. All right. So I go back to the hotel, get my wife, my dad, whatever, go back out. Tire's flat again.
So
I'm like, fuck, gosh. Big O, I'm not going back to Big O. So I go to Les Schwab, and Les Schwab finds a big hole right in the middle of the tread, and Big O, and Les Schwab says, yeah, we can't repair this tire. Well, the tire's a month and a half old. So then I got to put a new tire on it. It takes them 2 hours to put a tire on it. So my plan of being on the road at, you know, 5, 6 turns into being on the road at 11. So then I get home at 7.
That just makes for a wicked long day, man.
Dude, the funny thing is, when they're like, we can't find nothing, I'm like, yeah, that's what I do for a living. Tires don't go flat on their own. Something is wrong.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Well, I've had nothing but terrible experiences at our local Big O. I think like Big O sends you off to like some conference where they teach you how to be a shyster. I'm sorry if anyone works at Big O, but it's terrible. I had a tire puncture story. Do you want to hear this one?
Let's hear it.
So there I am. I'm driving down from Slips about a month ago, and I'm driving down and I'm having a good time. My windows roll down. I'm listening to a podcast. And, you know, I got my M17 in my hand, dry firing as I drive, as I'm wont to do. And I'm sitting there going by, and then all of a sudden, it sounds like somebody took a shotgun, put it inside my passenger window, and pulled the trigger. Like, I thought, literally, somebody was shooting at me, and then I was like, maybe they think I'm going to shoot at them with the gun or something like that. And I have this 5 seconds of terror, where I'm, like, looking around and trying to figure out, and then I see the oversized load that was to the right of me, blow one of those gigantic, one of those huge tires. Yeah. They were on the tractor trailer. So it was pulling a dump truck, and the dump truck, you know, is much bigger, but the tires underneath that went out right by my window with my windows down, and I thought somebody was trying to kill me. So that's what that story was. It's loud.
I've had that happen at work, same size tire, and I was only about 6 feet from the tire when it blew. Yeah, it gets your heart racing.
Yeah, there's if we've learned anything from shooting, there's nothing like when one gas enters into a big open vacuum, like, you know, just instantaneously. It's so great. Boosh. Hopefully you didn't get hit by any tire shrapnel, Kenny. Hope you're safe.
No, we're actually airing it up. It was in a cage when it went off, but dude, I've seen videos of them. If they're like on the ground and they blow, they'll hit the fucking roof of the shop.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Look it up, like on three piece rims, when they blow, like what hauls trains and shit. Mm-hmm. Like when they blow, they've killed people from blowing.
Oh wow. I'm just gonna keep drawing houses. It's safe. I mean, I may get a paper cut here and there, but you know, I'm probably not gonna die from that.
Yeah. Heck, if a tire blows when I'm at work, I'm just sitting there making money. Yeah, well, the tow truck will be there in 3 hours.
I will say, so Amazon, like when Amazon delivers something to your house, you can like click on the thing, you know, be delivered today. It'll bring up a map and it'll show where the delivery driver is and like how many stops they'll get to your house. That is the coolest thing in the history of forever. And I'm like, God bless you, Amazon.
UPS does the same thing with like preferred members or whatever like that if you join up online. And one of these days, I'm going to end up with a 22 bullet in my eye and my package truck empty. Guess what? You got nothing. You got a bunch of batteries and some weird stuff. Some sex products for some lady that lives up in Midway.
Oh, that's what the batteries are for.
So Midway's all the freaks are, huh?
They all got the money.
Dude,
they
I tell you.
Too much money.
Amazon left a package in my mailbox. Well, with the package was an empty Coke and an empty M&M package. I was like, really, Amazon?
That trash.
This was your fucking trash can?
Oh, my gosh. No, they're pirates. They're not even pirates, because pirates, I think, like live by a code. Anyways, we live by a code, and that's a show every week. Hit it, Phoenix.
Something really cool intro music here.
Out of the store. Anyways, welcome to the Paracast. I'm your host, Tomas the Boss Hernandez. And also, for this episode, once again, your editor. Thank you, Robert, for a 9.5 month break. That was fantastic. So, sucker. I'm going to try to edit this show, just because I don't want to pawn too much off on Robert. But joining me tonight, he's reminding you that the disappointment is what makes it hot. It's Robert Wyatt.
No. Disappointments for everybody. I mean, I'm sorry, okay? I'm just sorry. Next time, you know, you bring the lube.
And you call it a bathroom. He calls it an improvised drunk tank. It's Kenny Terry.
Is that supposed to be Steve Koski's?
I was going to say, that should have been Steve Koski's. That does seem appropriate to Steve.
Steve was going to be scheduled alcoholic. But you know it's an improvised drunk tank when it locks from the outside. Nope, you're too drunk. Go in here. Locking it up.
Let's be honest. Steve goes to Oktoberfest in September and then is suddenly surprised he gets arrested for, drunk and disorderly. You just kind of wonder. Steve, you should know better. But, his alcoholism is kind of on par with a high school student. Is it alcoholic? I will take three of it.
Does he just call anything Oktoberfest when he goes to the mountains and gets drunk?
Pretty much.
I think that's what it is. He takes two cases of natty ice, pulls over underneath the tree, and just starts pounding away.
Yeah. It's Oktoberfest, guys.
Steve, it's the middle of February. I don't care.
There's a bear walking by. He's like, more beer, maiden, more beer.
Well, he didn't drink for half of his life, and so he's trying to make up for it all. Problem is, he's using the cheapest beer on the planet, so it's going to take, three times as long to actually make up for the time delay. So, I don't know.
So he's making up with the worst beer possible.
I know, right?
We are talking to Steve about him going up to Oktoberfest, and today was a sober day to go up to Oktoberfest because he reminded us that he had scheduled that yesterday was his drunk day to go up to Oktoberfest. That's right. Circle it in the calendars, guys. It's drunk day. Good times. I'll tell you what I've been doing in the guns is one is playing the new Modern Warfare beta. If that count doesn't count for guns, I don't know what is. The new Modern Warfare game, the reboot, it's fantastic. It's fantastic. You do everything. You know what I've been doing? You get an MCX. I got an MCX carbine. I put the integral suppressor on it, all the cool attachments, running around shooting people in the face. Kenny, it's better than USPSA. Much better than USPSA. Until you do it for about 2 hours, then you're like, I want to go shoot some real stuff. But
is it as good as the original Modern Warfare?
Oh, it's awesome. As far as the multiplayer goes, it's so much fun. I love it. I called an A-10 airstrikes. It was so beautiful. So beautiful. I feel like Donald Trump when I say beautiful. Like a beautiful baby. It's so beautiful. It's beautiful. But I was messing around with that. Got some loading done. Put the 13-pound recoil spring in the M17 because, of course, if your hand can cycle the slide and it's easier for your hand, then it must be for shooting. That's the logic of it. So we'll see what happens with that. But just been practicing, doing that dry fire a lot, getting ready for a USPSA match during the day next Saturday, and a night match, of course, at night, hence the name night match.
Wait, that's next week?
I think it's next week, yes.
It's this coming up Saturday.
Yeah, it's coming up.
So are you?
Well, slips
are you,
up
are
Saturday, you, Rob.
All I care about is slips anyway. But are you going to shoot the bug match? Or are you going to shoot the slips and then you're going to motor down and?
I'm going to shoot the slips. Have a nice a couple hours and then go shoot the night match. I do not find. I don't know. I think bug matches are kind of cool. A bug match would be better if it was USPSA stages, like a regular USPSA day, but everyone brought a little bug gun. I think that would be more fun, kind of like what Idaho does.
Yeah, but then you'd have some certain winter soldier show up with his PO9 and say, yeah, this is my bug gun. He'd do it in a really clever accent. He'd do it in a clever Russian accent. I didn't say his name. I said winter soldier. You're the one who threw him under the bus and backed it up over him.
Paul, let me go forward one more time.
Beep, beep.
I've kind of been excited to shoot my little PX4 compact around, but I think
wait, that's going to be your bug match?
That's what I carry around. It's got a little 3.1-inch barrel. Well, that's not my fault it carries 15 rounds, and it's pretty cool.
It's not a backup gun.
Yeah, well, that is. That's plenty.
Well, you say backup. Night match, get over.
Sometimes, in my annals of doing the night match, sometimes at 11, sometimes at 3. So it just kind of depends on the year. Guess what? The 3 o'clock one stopped being fun about 12:45 is where the fun goes to bed, everybody. Then you're just slogging through.
So I want to shoot it, but I got to work Sunday. So if it's over at 3, that means I got to be to work at 6.
Oh, Kenny, you're too fast. You'll just shoot through. Come out and have fun. Shoot it at night. It'll be a good time.
You know
I'll
what,
let
Kenny,
you even borrow a weapon light.
Here's the deal. Don't go down there. Save the gas. Just go to West Valley. you can have your own night match all on your own. Just hang out in the Walmart parking lot, you know, crank a few beers back, light a few homies up.
I feel like you're making fun of my childhood now.
Are you kidding? I love the Walmart in Taylorsville because it is statistically like the most or the best chance in the entire state of Utah that I could actually shoot somebody with a gun. I'm kind of like really fortunate for that.
I don't know. The one on 56 in West Valley might have you beat.
Oh, that one is that one is pretty sketchy.
That one's already had shootings, multiple shootings at it. So
I don't know. Okay. So what we'll do is at 10 o'clock, we'll hit the Taylorsville one. And then we'll roll on over to West Valley. It can kind of be a multi-jurisdictional thing.
There we go.
Nothing's getting going at midnight over there anyways. All the real stuff happens at like 2 a.m.
When the bars let out.
When the bars let out. It's good. It's go time, everybody. So what did you two get up to, Kenny?
Oh, shit. So I drove to Colorado Thursday after work. Decided to shoot Colorado State all day Friday. And then drove home Saturday. It was a long couple days.
So besides, blowing out your tire, selling a rocket crack to the Big O tire to get them on the ball, how'd you shoot the match?
I don't know. I shot pretty good. I mean, for everything that happened, I didn't have very much sleep going into it. I'm pretty happy with how I shot. I've never shot 13 stages in one day. And it was experience. Towards the end of the day, it was getting pretty tough. I was losing my gun handling as good as it normally is. Honestly, with everything said and done, I'm pretty happy that I lost the match by 1 point. But
damn it!
Yeah.
Well, this is what happens. You need to start. Listen, I'm sorry someone's going to have to break this to you, Kenny. But you're not winning by much and you're not losing by much. So you need to get a whole lot better, okay?
Thank you.
Someone had to tell you, your margin for error is too close for comfort.
All right, and I'm going to be the nice friend, and I'm just going to say, if you shoot with ROs, you're taking a 10% hit on your score no matter what anyway. So
yeah. It
is what it is. But, I mean, that's still, one point is still pretty legit.
Yeah, I was just telling you, I want to be mad about it, but at the same time, it's like I didn't shoot in the best conditions. I mean, on the range for 11 hours.
Yeah, and I mean, they were conditions that were not necessarily under your control. I mean, like, because usually everybody knows when you shoot with ROs, well, on staff day anyway, a good chunk of that day is spent with all the ROs arguing over something, and then the other chunk of the day is spent with them fixing the stages to make them actually legal for it, and then you have to go and reshoot half of them.
Yeah.
So it's you're always taking a hit on your actual score. And so the ROs going into it, shooting the match, they know their match is going to generally suck. And so the poor people who have to shoot through, like in your situation, I mean, hats off to you because it's going to be a rough day no matter what.
Yeah. Now, Kenny, my question for you was, now once you figured out you lost by 1 point, how mad were you at like those few Charlies that you shot that could have been A's? Because normally you shoot those Charlies, you're just like, whatever, I'm going fast, I'm making those Charlies. And then you lose by like 1 percentage point and you're just like, son of a bitch, I shoot way too many Charlies. You know what?
It wasn't the points it cost me. I think I shot the best points in limited. But the problem is like our last two stages were speed shoots. And when you start getting tired, speed shoots aren't really the best thing to be shooting when you're. So, you know, I fumbled the draw and fumbled the reload on both of them. And when you give up 2 seconds on a 6 second stage, it's a lot of points.
See, that's why I just like to like be the third place, because second place, you're basically the first loser. And so you have to live with like you're being a loser for the rest of your life. But third place, you're just happy you got something. How's that a win?
That's why when you win, they tell you they won. And when you're in third, you say, I got on the podium. Those are both positive things. What do you say in second? Why you missed first? Like third place, you're just like, I'm happy to be here. Happy to hit the podium. Like, then it's a positive thing. You're in the worst position, Kenny, because you can't go back in time. You can't reshoot that match. And so you have to live with that defeat for the rest of your life.
You're getting gangbanged by first and third place no matter what you do. You just don't want to be like, you know, in the middle of that sandwich.
So what you're saying is I need to get a lot better or a lot worse.
Sorry, Tommy.
Got it.
A lot better, Kenny. Come on. You're good, and we're happy that you're very good. But we would like the margin of error to be like way less.
That's
like, I would like to congratulate you halfway through the day. Like, if I'm done shooting the match and you're halfway through, I'd just like to get the congratulations over with so I don't have to remind myself to congratulate you later.
Yeah.
Like, let's step it up. Let's do more work.
Yeah, we don't want to know that you won. We want to know that you absolutely showed up and decimated every single person to the point that you could be still, yes, like, you know, show up to stage, you know, 11 or 12 of the, you know, 13 stage match and be like, I don't even have to shoot this. That's how much I'm going to beat all you jerks.
Just going to walk away. Sorry, guys. Got to go home. Beat the traffic.
Half my major matches this year have been within 5 points.
I just go, beat your you ass. Work now I'm going to go beat the traffic. That's what you do. You walk away.
Beat traffic.
Life goals right there, baby.
Yeah.
Beat everybody by so many points that you can just stop, not even shoot two stages. I've only done that once, and it was the most glorious IDPA match ever.
IDPA, that's one where you can actually do it. You can actually beat guys with the time plus. Time plus, you can do it. With a time plus scoring system, you can technically get so far ahead that you can't do it. USPSA, you'd never be able to do it because, like, 0% of, like, 30 match points is, like, this abyss. Like, even if you took the shortest stage, it's hard to even get through it.
Yeah,
but Robert, what'd you do?
Yeah, so I kept working on my guns. I finally got the grips in from LOK Grips. That was very nice. I was happy to get those finally. Went and shot.
And these are the CZ Limited guns.
Yeah, the Tac Sports, or the CTSs, I guess, technically.
The real guns.
Yeah. Oh, they're fun. It is so much fun to shoot that division. But you know what? So last Saturday, we shot that LTD match, and some turkey decided he was going to complain about the classifier, and so they throw the classifier out of the match. And I'm like, I shot that thing freaking good, you jerk faces. I have no idea who did it, but it pissed me off. So, like, at the indoor match, I'm like, well, we're running two classifiers at this match because somebody's got to go down to Nationals with a classification. So we set up two classifiers, and we ran two classifiers, and then we proceeded to set up four more stages, and we shot that. Yeah. It was actually that indoor match. We started at 6:30. We got over about 9:45. That match is turning out to be one of the funner matches I get to shoot because we actually had six legitimate, unique stages. And I mean, they were speed shooty kind of stages. We had we had the big combined one where we take the two stages, combine them together, and let you shoot like a 24 point round stage. But man, it was just a fun match. And so I got my classification in. So I'll at least go down to Nationals with a letter of some sorts, which honestly is all I care about. My whole goal shooting
it's going to be A.
Yeah.
You can't be less than an A.
Exactly. Yeah. It's just going to be that way. And so my whole point is, like, don't zero the stage. You know, draw the gun nice and easy. Oops, there's a mic.
Yeah.
I don't care. It doesn't matter.
Yep. They're flipping through the book. 43, 44, 62, 57. A to me, everybody. Moving along.
But no, it's been good. And so this whole week, I've been loading up bullets, and like none of them were passing the case gauge, like maybe half. And I couldn't figure it out. And finally, I was talking to Kenny, and he's like, "Yeah, you need to get this Mr. Bullet Feeder. It's the powder funnel for the DAA uses as a replacement for the 650." And I'm like, "Okay." So I hop onto Ben Steger Pro Shop, order that thing. It came in yesterday, and I threw it in, got everything all redialed back in, and sure enough, I mean, that thing solves every problem that you ever have. I mean, the bullets, they drop nice and straight in because before they were kind of a little bit cockeyed. And so as it's trying to seat, sometimes it wouldn't straighten it out properly. And so it would fail the case gauge. But now the way that Mr. Bullet Feeder powder funnel works, it creates this nice little well so that the bullet just sits nice, perfectly upright, and it just goes in perfect. And I was like, this is the simplest solution I've ever seen in my life. But it works.
Is this problem unique just to 40, Kenny?
Yeah, mostly.
Because it's a bastard child of a case?
I think it's because it's a straight wall case, man. Because the taper case of the 9mm doesn't... I know people who do it with the... They use the Mr. Bullet Feeder one for that because they sell it. But I've only ever experienced this with the 40 Smith & Wesson.
Yeah.
For me, at least, coated bullets are always worse with it also in 40.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And that would make sense because it's usually a little bit of a wider diameter. than a standard jacket or plated bullet. And so that makes a lot of sense.
That's always the worst when you have a coated bullet that's kind of canted and you're seating it. Because you know the back end of some of that thing sheared off in the case somehow if it went in kind of crooked. And so you're just like, well, here we go. But then you go like out of sight, out of mind.
Yeah. What was it, like 20, 30 bucks, Rob?
I think it was like 43 bucks shipped.
No.
Honestly, I don't care.
It makes it so much easier.
Yeah, if it solves a problem, I actually don't care what it costs. Because, I mean, for me, I don't case gauge to see if they'll actually pass the case gauge. I case gauge with the hundo so that I can see high primers. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, even the stuff that doesn't pass the case gauge, you throw it in your barrel and it's gonna pass. Yeah. I mean, sometimes you'll find like a cracked case or something like that, which is fantastic. But for me, it's always about finding the high primers and being able to see all 100 bullets just sitting there and comparing all the primers. It's very easy to see a primer that's just a skosh too high. And you can pull it out, put it into your hand primer and just seat it down properly and, keep motoring on. But that's why I like it. And so, but now to have them all just drop plunk straight in, it's fantastic. I wish I had known about that thing like way earlier because that's been awesome.
What you need to do with those high primers is save them all. And then when you're done with the class, put them in your SIG and see how many of them you can get to slam fire.
I like the way you think.
That's the way to do it. See, guess what? Only do it once because I did it with I don't know if I told this on the podcast yet. I did it with the Federals with the NATO brass. And so the Federals are so soft that they'll kind of like not go all the way in and they'll leave like this ripple or this lip out there.
Yep.
Well, guess what, kids? That ripple is still active. And so I was sitting there shooting some practice ammo and I was like, well, practice ammo is an IE ammo that did not pass case gauge. And I got like four or five of these things and I'm like, you know what would be cool? Like they won't feed because the primer setting up so it's not getting on the extractor, so it's not going in.
Oh no.
And so I was like, you know what I'm going to do? I'm just going to put it in the chamber. And then I was like, that's kind of high. The breech face looks like it might impact the primer off. So I aimed it at the target, dropped the slide stop, and you know what happened?
Bam.
Bam. And I was like, hell yeah, that's pretty sweet. And so it was kind of cool. Well, like, it's not the firing pin because the firing pin's not moving. And so I grabbed another one and I put it in the chamber. I was like, well, that's cool. Let's see if we can get it again. And then I thought to myself, Thomas, if you do not have that thing completely in the chamber when you drop the slide and it shovels out a bit, and then the back of the slide still hits it, we could have a detonation that's not fully supported by the chamber. And I thought to myself, that's probably not a smart idea. Since we're not aiming directly down, let's go ahead and take this out because it just slides out just a little bit and then all of a sudden it's kaboom. I'm missing one finger, and I'm out $600. So
that's why I only do it with Glocks, man.
If you would like to make your own hazardous ammunition, don't head over to GallantBolts.com because they don't endorse that. But if you want to make fine quality ammunition, GallantBolts.com, use promo code PewPro10 and save 10% off your first order when you buy those 4,115 grain bullets because you're either going to get the 135s or the 115s, two ends of the spectrum, like the best middle weight, or you just want all the bullets. Head on over, do that, or you can get that 180 grain stuff. These two are now shooting cannibals. They're just madmen shooting that. Promo code PewPro10. Also, facebook.com/PracticalArmResponseAcademy. Give us a like. We almost have 1,100 likes. That's more likes than we were promised at birth for all of us combined. So head on over there, hit the blue button. When we ask for questions, you may ask us questions, and patreon.com/paracast and Subscribestar.
Yeah.
Search Paracast there. Dollar a month gives you a longer, uncensored version of the show. Robert?
All right, from Tony Carter. What's your thoughts on the different weight 9mm bullets, 115, 124, 135, or 147, or adding to his, I like the 165s. Oh, 165. Yeah.
165. Is that like a separate revolver load? Some of these guys in the 9mm revolvers have like, I got 152 grain bullets. And you like look at this abortion of a bullet. It's like, the hell is this thing? Well, it's a 357 bullet in a 9mm case, and I have it chambered. Like, you know, revolver people spend so much time putting all this stuff together. Just buy a semi-automatic. You know, it'll do what you want.
All I'm saying, goodness man, gracious. Is, you know, you take one of those 165 grain bullets, because you can put it through your swager and you can kind of squish it down to a 356 diameter. And then you throw that thing in, put a little tiny bit of powder behind it. It makes a great suppressor round. I mean, it's good for backyard shooting. Just throwing that out there.
Of course, if you ever had to use that, they would like just hang you, like use it in self-defense. They just hang you as the jury. Just put a rope around. He's making man killer bullets. 147 wasn't enough for this son of a bitch. He wanted more bullets. He wanted them dead, and he wanted them dead quick.
Well, I tried doing 180 grain 40 Smith and Wesson, but I just couldn't swage it enough. So I just had this real cocoa effect.
Gotta clean the die again. All right, so bullet weights. Kenny, let's get your 40 caliber opinion. 45, it's 230. It's 230. 230 works. Mixed power, great power factor. Soft shooting.
Yeah.
Unless you're just trying to be a maniac in 45, but 40 caliber, Kenny.
I was actually thinking of trying 150 in 45. I think it would.
Okay. Do it. Yeah. The slide would come back and knock your teeth out after like 3,000 rounds. That's what happened to it.
40, I run 180. 200s are just too slow. But he was talking about 9mm, right?
Yeah, he was.
So, yeah.
And 9mm, I like 147s. But that's every other bullet weight I felt like the slide moved too much for my liking.
The 147s are nice. Generally, for me, I find, depending on the kind of sights you set up, like if you get sights from Dawson and stuff like that, it generally seems like they're all kind of set up for 124 grain bolts. The 147s will hit a little bit higher. They are softer shooting, and they're pretty accurate, being as heavy as they are. The problem comes from with the heavier bullets is just really price, and if you get kind of some of the unique stuff, kind of like the low data. Robert?
You know, I'll be honest. I think that the bullet weight is highly dependent on the gun itself. My Shadow 2s, they just really like 125 or 135 grain bullet. My original Shadows, the 147s were pretty dang awesome. When I shot a Glock, it was a 147. My M9A3, it likes 115 grain bullets.
Yeah.
So it's one of those deals where if I'm picking up a brand new to me gun, honestly, and it's in 9mm, I'm actually going to go buy each one of those and just shoot a bunch and just see what that particular gun likes, because that seems to have been the best way to decide. I understand your opinion on like the 147s and stuff like that, but it just really feels like the gun tends to tell me what it wants to shoot more than anything.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's very dependent on the shooters too. I mean, if you just look at the high-end shooters and carry optics, they're not all shooting one bullet weight. You can look at people using the same gun and they're still not shooting the same bullet weight.
Yeah.
Yeah. And for me, like this past year, I've been shooting almost exclusively 115 grain gallons. And the couple things that I like about it seems to me that 115 grain bullet, just perception, just kind of seems to go a little bit better to where my sights are hitting. And they also seem to be, I don't know, the recoil impulse, even though it's a little bit sharper, it just seems to be a little bit quicker. And so sometimes in some applications that can be good. Generally, if you're trying to move your budget, like you're going to get 400 more bullets per case every time you kind of make that step in around that, every time you make that step to a lower grain bullet. And it just seems to work. And if the gun's working and you got a load that works for you, grab whatever bullet you like. The one thing I would say is that Masada Yu was telling me one time that it is very hard for European guns to actually stabilize the 147 grain bullets, the heavier bullets, because generally European guns use a slower rifling because they don't use that 147 grain stuff where they're from. And so like the first, I think the Gen 1 Walthers, I believe was the story he was telling me about, had a hard time grouping the 147s, the ones with the European magazine release and stuff like that. So I think that's kind of interesting, that twist rate. We think about that with rifles, but you got to kind of figure it out with your gun, because some guns like some things a little bit more.
Yeah, no, and that's why I think it really just, I mean, on a brand new gun, I think I would always just grab a handful of each and just shoot them a bunch and just probably just see what works best to you. And from what Kenny just said, I mean, what the gun likes and what, how you interact with that gun with those rounds cycling, I think you'll probably, I don't think you'll go wrong, basically.
Well, yeah, I think there's a lot of things. I mean, what springs are you running, all that. I mean, it's just like everything in shooting, it depends.
Yeah. All right, from Chris Loki. I'm going to spend the winter in practice with the intention of joining USPSA in the spring. What are some things to keep in mind about gear? I'll be shooting production. Any tips on what to avoid, such as buying too many belts, mags, mag holders, etc.? I don't want to show up at my first match looking like an idiot. Thanks for the advice. Love the show as always.
What should we do not to look like an idiot? I think be conservative. Well, you know, the holster is going to depend on your gun to see if some of the great, the bigger manufacturers make a holster for your gun. But generally, a softer shooter's connection for $40 for a belt. You know, buy, I think we're all in agreement that if you buy the 073 Safariland pouches and mount those directly to the belt, you're in good shape there. Get five of those and some sort of slightly dropped holster setup and practice with that all winter and you'll be good.
I think the belt is largely going to be whatever you want, whether it's the Dominate Defense like what Kenny has, because I'm kind of liking the idea of the adjustable belts now, or you get a Safariland. Safariland is tried and true. You'll never go wrong with that. But yeah, get yourself like a gun that will support the Ben Steger Pro Shop. What is it? The Blade Tech Boss mounts. That's pretty common. Most people like that. It gives you the flexibility of running the gun up high, in, out, stuff like that. Some people prefer their gun actually sitting higher. Some people want it a little bit lower, all within the division rules. But you're never going to go wrong with like the 074, Tommy?
Yeah.
You guys run the 073, don't you?
The 073s, yeah. The 07...
The 771s. The 771s are the more competition-oriented ones.
771s what I run. You guys run 773s.
That's right.
773s. The 074s are more like a concealment magazine pouch. That'll work pretty good.
Yeah, the 771s are really nice because they are split at the opening, and so it does allow you to kind of like just rip those mags out just a skosh bit faster. I don't know that it's entirely necessary, but you can't deny that when everybody's like saying, yeah, it lets you get the magazine out, it does actually get that magazine out a touch bit faster.
Yeah. Just good gear and good practice with it, and you'll do yourself just fine. You really will.
Safariland has sale right now too, right, Tom? Rob?
Yep.
30% off for the rest of the month.
Yeah, it's 30. It's 30 or 40. It depends on kind of like when you hit them.
Honestly, they're making pretty good holsters right now too, and you can use their adjustable hangers, their adjustable hanger as well.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, and there's a lot of people who make different mounting options for Safariland holsters. I have a Frank Proctor mount I use for mine. It looks kind of weird, but when you put it on, it feels pretty great. And honestly, going to safariland.com right now and using that promo code, I think you can get 5 773s with the inch and a half belt loop for like $102, and they ship anything over $100 free. So like getting all your pouches done, 5 good ones for $100 ain't too shabby.
Yep.
All right, from Ruben Garcia. I recently bought a backup and it was set up for carry optics and it came with 2 Romeo 1s. Thinking of putting them on my G19 for kicks and giggles, but what would I need an adapter plate? Are adapter plates stupid? Would that make the dot too high, or should I just get a slide cut to fit the dot?
I would recommend not getting your slide cut to fit the Romeo 1. I don't think that's something that somebody has said and someone went, that's a great idea. I think running the adapter plates is perfectly fine when you're not committed all the way to an optic. And listen, the adapter plates can have trouble, but it's just like anything else on carry optics. Carry optics seems to be the division of standard operating procedures to make sure that the gun still works. Like, make sure the dots tighten. Make sure the battery compartment on, like, the vortexes and stuff like that hasn't come loose so the dot doesn't shake loose or come off. Make sure that stuff's all tightened down. Well, make sure that things are retaining zero.
Probably the most important thing for any carry optic shooter is, like, in your iPhone, like, under favorites, make sure you have the warranty department of whatever company's optic that you have.
That's only if your name's Robert Wyatt.
This is true. Although I do have a friend who broke his fifth Romeo, so kind of like, awkward.
Oh, shit.
He was shooting a Shadow 2. We're just going to kind of continue that questionable narrative about the Shadow 2's breaking optics.
No, definitely go with it. If you got an MOS gun, use the plate. Use the plate. And honestly, if you're just getting into it and screwing around, if you just want to, you do not have an MOS type setup, using the dovetail plates is just fine for going around and screwing around.
Absolutely.
Listen, like 100 draws, and you're not really going to notice it. Gosh, that Vortex Venom on my X-Carry sits up. Like, the X-Carry already has a high bore axis, and then it's got a plate, and then it's got that Venom. It sits up like I was teacupping the grip. Like, it's just way up there, up in the sky. And, you know, a few rounds later, you don't even notice it.
Yeah.
You hold it at chin level, and then you can see through it with your eye, and you're just perfectly fine.
The only problem with the dovetail cuts is on close targets, you're going to be impacting low. But a little bit of practice, you get used to that, and know how to adjust it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Hide over bore with handguns. We've entered the crazy world, everybody.
All right, from Nick Cornell. Looking at the European results, what planet is Eric Raffel from? Jeez, that guy is Superman with a gun, I tell you what.
One freaking Delta.
One Delta on the entire match. It's like, holy jeez. That's unreal. That or he's just slipping all of the ROs like $100 bills every time he shows up to the stage. I mean, either way, it's still a win.
Yeah. CZ's got to be happy about that.
Dude, CZ's got to be happy that the top three guys are all CZ people.
I know.
How about Maria being third?
I mean, that's pretty legit. Yeah.
Maria finishing third was pretty.
Now, I remember some story about Griffel before Nationals. What was it, 2014? Sorry, 2014 World Shoot. Him talking like he had like 4 or 5 months before World Shoot, and he said that he was going to shoot like something like 60,000 rounds or something like that, if I remember the story. But it calculated out to be like 1,300 rounds a day. And it was just like, that's what I'm going to do. And, you know, some speculation was that he was telling that to get into everybody's mind. But when you see Griffel, you're just like, no, he's probably doing that. He's probably that dedicated.
I'll tell you, he's an interesting person. I listen to all the podcasts he's on stuff. He's interesting of how he attacks stages and how he attacks a match. And he does shoot a shit ton.
Wow.
Like, I can't remember what podcast it was on. He was talking about, like, when he sees stages, he'll try to, like, attack his opponent's flaws. Like, if it's a stage that he thinks his opponent's not going to be good on, like, he'll try to attack that stage harder to show his opponent's flaws more.
Huh. Yeah.
So he shoots well to make others feel bad about themselves.
I mean, that's like when Kenny shoots.
He's interesting. I mean,
no, but
it's phenomenal to watch. I mean, it's.
Yeah. Would you say that he's probably the best shooter in the world right now? I mean, put a gun.
He's the best shooter in the world the last 15 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, when's the last time he lost Worlds?
Wow. True.
Yeah. As far as the great like handgun shooters, like USPSA competitors, like Griffel's it. Like, when he stepped in and kind of Lathan faded out of it, Griffel's it. I think the greatest shooter in the world is Mitch Lick. I think the greatest all-around shooter in the world is Mitch Lick. And, like, I was just watching some of his stuff, and, like, he just had a 65th birthday, and you're just like, oh, he's still winning things? Like, yeah, he's pretty good.
Yeah, if you're going, you know, like this if you're going all-around, it's got to be Mitch Lick if you go all-around. But if it goes handguns, it has to be Griffel.
It's Griffel. Yeah.
I mean, he's won worlds in every division.
Jeez.
Except for Revolver Shark. He has another Revolver, right?
Yeah, but who would? We don't count that, Kenny. Come on. Yeah.
I'm sure he'll do it in PCC soon. And probably carry off, or what do they call their production optics?
Production optics, yeah. 15 rounds.
It's just interesting when you see a guy who can dominate JJ, and then you realize how like phenomenal JJ is, and you're just like, this is another step, everybody. Hey, good on CZ, man.
You're not even kidding. I mean, he dominates JJ. I mean, I love JJ. He's a super nice guy, but Griffel is he's something else.
Yeah, yeah. It's amazing.
If you think about it, I mean, this is what he's done for a living, pretty much his entire life since he was a kid. I mean, shooting 100,000 rounds a year for the last 20 years. I mean, it's going to
make some kind of a difference. See, I want to know, how long does a gun last at that point? I mean, how many guns is he going through in a year? Because eventually you've got to be shooting those barrels out.
I bet you probably have a... like, you're probably not doing as much dry fire practice because you're probably spending a lot of time at the range, but I'm guessing you have a match gun and you have two backup guns. Well, you have a match gun, probably a backup gun, and maybe two practice guns. Because you got to imagine that if you're going to shoot 100,000 rounds a year, about 50,000 rounds in, something's seriously going to bite it pretty freaking hard. I mean, it's probably going to bite it pretty hard every 10,000 rounds. Something's going to shear off or break.
Well, if you're shooting 1,000 rounds.
He probably has a lot of guns because I'm sure he's not working on them. So he's probably got a lot of guns just getting swapped and, you know, CZ.
Yeah, true.
I'm guaranteed he's not working on his guns.
Yeah. But, yeah. That's a job just to keep him shooting, pretty much.
Yeah, it was on a Firearms Nation podcast he was talking. He's only lost, like, one major in the last, like, 15 years.
Jeez. Could you imagine? Yeah. Could you imagine the guy that actually was the one who beat him at that one major?
Vogel at Pro-Am.
Okay, there you go. Vogel's like, and I will hang my head up. Thank you for coming. I am now retired.
And that's like you listen to Vogel stories, and like that's Vogel's like top story when I beat Grafel at the Pro-Am when he beat him in a shoot-off by like 0.2 seconds.
But I mean, we all know how much confidence and the mental side plays of shooting. If you've only lost one major in the last 15 years, how much does that help your mental side? No, you have to think, yeah, I'm winning this match. And then everybody going against him, they have to think, I'm probably not going to win. I mean, it's he can play mental games on people that way.
Well, that was like Nils showing up to Utah State. I mean, the battle in Kerry Optics was for who was going to take second.
Yeah, or at least be the positive one who podiums. Right, Kenny?
Yep.
Going for third, baby.
All right, right on. Let's do one more.
Okay, let's see here. It'll be kind of a combination from Dave Blanton and Ruben Garcia, but Dave Blanton says, explain the process of getting a Nats spot, and Ruben Garcia says, why should I shoot Nats, and why shouldn't I shoot Nats?
Have no idea, and I don't really have an interest in it, but Kenny, Robert, explain.
So for getting a national slot, there's a couple ways. If you are the area champion...
Ethical ones, Kenny, ethical. Okay. No doing things behind the porta potty.
I don't know then. That's the only way I get my national slots. So when it being
Kenny's
your
like, you can fit three people in a porta potty. You can fit three people. I know it. Not for a fact.
So winning your area match, so area one this year, I was third at area one, but I was technically the area one champion. I was the highest area one. So I'll get a slot for next year. So doing that guarantees you a slot. Or top 15 at nationals guarantees you a slot. I think that's it.
No, those it's just a slot. It's not a paid entry. It's just a slot.
Yeah, you still got to pay. It's just a slot.
Right.
And then all for like Utah has our own bylaws of how to get a slot. And I think every state has their own bylaws for that.
Yeah, and that's all based on club participation within the state.
Yeah, so Utah, you get a slot by your... how many matches you've done well in, your points in matches, and then they give out the slots to the people that have done the best. How many slots Utah's given.
And then barring that, you know, whoever is left over after that who still wants one.
Yeah.
Yep. But
really just go win your area match and you don't gotta worry about it.
Oh yeah, that's the super easiest way to do it for sure.
Easiest way.
By far.
And the one that takes the most time is offer to work it, correct?
Yeah.
Well, the working it's worthless because now you can't even get a slot to shoot the match if you work it. I mean, they'll give you they'll pay room and board and all that stuff, but you still have to actually get into the match into whatever the next match is if you want to shoot it, which kind of sucks. So stupid. It's the dumbest thing in the world. I don't know why USPSA did it, but they say that's how they've always done it. But it was, I mean. A little bit of an angry rant here. It's the stupidest thing they ever did in the entire world because down in St. George, they had an entire pool of people that would have worked that match locally in exchange for a slot so they could just shoot it. But instead, USPSA is going to take all of the money that's coming in off that thing, and they're going to pay to compensate people flying in to work the match that they would have otherwise had for free by just letting the locals run it. It was just, it's stupid.
Them saying that's the way it's always been is bullcrap too.
Yep.
Because in 2015, I had a friend that went and RO'd the Florida Nats, and that's how it was. He got to shoot one, he RO'd the other, and they gave him $250 cash for RO'ing it.
That's how
I don't know why they're all of a sudden now saying, Yeah, I don't know why then now also I'm saying it's like we're not stupid, Troy. We know it's not truth.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, the one thing I would say is like for a sport that's run completely on participation, like the people who volunteer for the big major matches, who volunteer their time and vacation stuff to go do it, like shooting it is part of the thrill. Like the game does not go on without these people.
Mm-hmm.
And like if you have the people who are constantly going down, like that. That is about the fairest trade or the fairest deal in USPSA is basically I come work this match for 2 or 3 days, I shoot this match for free, and the sport continues on.
And if you think about it, it's kind of a dick move to not give that because you're basically making it so that the only people that are going to come to that match are, and don't get me wrong when I say this, it's the old people who have kind of pieced out of the game already. It's not the competitors or like, you know, like somebody like me or Steve or something like that who would come down and shoot this thing in exchange for working it. That's a good deal. But when you're talking most average people in this game, they're not retired. They've got lives. They've got, you know, families. And you're asking them essentially to give up an entire week of what is their vacation time for what? For nothing. Just for the joy of being an RO and getting a really nice knife at the end of it and a t-shirt and maybe you get to share a room with some sweaty other RO. I mean, thanks, but that's kind of no thanks. I mean, obviously you're an RO because you love the game and you want to see it grow. But I just can't help but think that this was not – I just thought it was kind of uncool for them not to take advantage of the local talent that they had down in St. George. I could be wrong. I'm wrong on a lot of things. I just don't think I am in this case. Mm. Well, what about
why to shoot Nats? You get to get placed up against the best people in the nation, and you'll see how good you actually are.
Yeah, and maybe you'll do well enough that you'll be in the super squad. Who knows? But you never know unless you go try. Because imagine that. You're not going to win, folks. Let's face facts. You're not going to win. If you're listening to the show, you're not going to win. But you might get in the Nils super squad.
That's why I said that.
Yeah.
Oh.
He's not listening.
He's not listening to this. You're on this podcast. He hates you. Everyone knows that. Jewish Kitty. But, you know, you at least would have to say, like, hey, in the year of 2019, guess what, folks? I was one of the top 16 shooters in USPSA. And then your neighbor will say,
so?
Oh, in the world? And you're like, no, in the nation. But 16 in the nation. Well, not actually in my division. Well, how many divisions are there? There's like 27 of them now. So like 27 times 16, you're in there. But you're in the hunt. You're in the hunt, everybody.
Yeah, but then they drop the hammer and they're like, good. Yeah, but you were shooting a rifle at a pistol match. So.
And then you go cry in the corner.
Exactly.
And that's when you peace out. But then you get to say, but I was the most accurate shooter at a pistol match with my PCC.
And they say, did you bring a cover garment too?
And when they keep asking questions, you slap them in the face and you say, only Tom Nelson will ask the questions now. Because, ladies and gentlemen, this is the end of the Paracast. That's right, but it's not the official. Well, it's the official end of the Paracast, but we got one more thing to do. Because we haven't done this in such a long time, we have to introduce the segment again, which is called Dead or Alive. That's right, folks. We turn this show into a game show where I ask one, Robert Wyatt and Kenny Terry, questions, which they have to answer these trivia questions to see who will become the Dead or Alive champion for the episode that was recorded on the 15th of September of 2019. So, let me grab a pen.
No, don't open Google. It'll crash your computer.
You can't Google.
Besides, I don't want competition for when I open Google.
So, ladies and gentlemen, we now enter the world of Dead or Alive. Hit it, John.
Dead or Alive. Oh, John was going to sing it. Dang it. Dead or Alive.
This program is about unsolved mysteries. Whenever possible, the actual family members and police officials have participated in recreating the events. What you're about to see is not a news broadcast.
All right, guys, on this episode of Dead or Alive, we are stepping into a world of mystery. Unsolved mysteries? Maybe, because I, today, will give you a mystery, and you will tell me if it is solved or unsolved in the game I like to call maybe Unsolved Mysteries, hosted by Robert Stack. Here we go. So our first question is, I'll give you each a turn. I will read you a mystery, and you will tell me if that mystery is solved or unsolved. And If you can name the perpetrator of the crime, if it is solved, a bonus point shall be awarded.
Hot dog.
Yes, Robert Kuklinski did get solved.
No, we're not Kuklinski. Who the heck are you talking about? Ted Kaczynski? Who Robert Kuklinski is? Who's Robert Kuklinski?
He was a mob hitman, supposedly killed like over 300 people.
Good for him. I mean, that's, you know, that's pretty cool that a guy has that much like job satisfaction that he wants to do a good job.
They call him the Iceman. You guys don't know this?
I know who the Iceman
was.
I'll
have to look it up.
He cried when his cat died.
It's nice to see job security. Am I right?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely.
In July of 1918, the assassination of Nicholas II and his family. What happened to his daughter, Anastasia? Solved or unsolved mystery? Robert says it is solved. Kenny?
I have no freaking
idea. Be honest.
I have no idea.
No, us.
Anastasia?
Unsolved. So he.
It was too
Anastasia
solved.
It was solved. Robert, who committed the crime?
I don't know the person's name, but I know the Bolsheviks. Was it the Bolsheviks?
Bolsheviks. Good point. Robert's 2 points up. There you go.
I have a feeling Robert's going to sweep this.
In 1971, a man named Dan Cooper boarded a flight on a Boeing 727. He claimed he had a bomb, received $200,000 in ransom, and then jumped off the plane into the night. Not yet, Robert.
Damn it.
Not yet. You gotta wait till you both reveal it at the
same
time.
I'm good with this story.
So I actually got
the
this one.
The mystery is D.B. Cooper. Gentlemen, reveal your answers now.
Unsolved.
Kenny, that's an unsolved. Robert, you said unsolved?
Uh-huh.
You are both correct. So, unsolved. We still do not know what happened to one Dan Cooper. We did recover $5,000 of the money in 1979 that was washed up.
On a bank.
But we do not know if he made it into the night safely. So, a couple people thought he did.
I think he did.
Here we go. Number three. A man who claimed to have killed 37 people with 7 confirmed victims in the San Francisco area in the late 1960s to 1970s. He left ciphers and went by the name of Zodiac. Solved or unsolved mystery? Okay, reveal your answers. Kenny?
Unsolved.
Unsolved. Robert?
Solved.
I'm sorry, Kenny, you're catching up there. The Zodiac Killer has not been solved.
If we can start doing some like more mass murders and stuff, like that's kind of my hobby outside of
what are you, trying to say there, Steve or Kenny? I'm kind of curious. I know who I'm not sharing a hotel room with again.
he's got it. You open up his wallet and it's a picture of BTK. He's just like, hey, oh, I'm sorry.
BTK was kind of lame. All those notes he left.
Oh, he's moving stuff along. He's moving stuff along. Okay. An expedition into Canada. This is Sir John Franklin's expedition into Canada with 130 men to find the Northwest Passage, never to be heard from again. This is in the 1845. Left into Canada with 130 men, never to be heard from again. Solved or unsolved mystery? Gentlemen, reveal your answers. Robert says?
Solved.
I said solved.
Kenny, you both are correct. It was solved. In 1848, they found a log that ended in 1848 where they had a bunch of the ships stuck in the ice, and the men spent 3 years trying to free these ships out of the ice before going their own way after 23 men died. And then they died out in the Canadian wilderness. What a shit story. Am I right or am I right? What a bad job. That sucks.
Well,
poor guys.
That's scurvy and lead poison will get you.
Robert has 4. Kenny has 3. Here we go. In 1979 through 1981, children were kidnapped and killed in around Atlanta, Georgia. Was the killer ever found?
Oh, geez. This was on that show that I never finished watching.
Killer ever found?
I have no idea.
I think this is right.
Kenny says solved. Robert?
It should say unsolved. I don't know if you can see it.
We're all tied up, folks. We're all tied up. Four to four. Kenny, can you name the killer?
I can't remember who it was. Who was it?
Wayne Williams. Pudgy, overweight, black guy with an afro and glasses who went around as a talent scout would lure these boys in. Didn't do anything sexual to them, but just strangle them and kill them and then dump their bodies.
We're getting really, folks, for a shooting show, we're getting really morbid here.
Yeah, so it's getting pretty dark.
Hey,
are we talking about John Wayne Gacy next?
I don't know who that is. I should know who that is.
Okay, number six. We're all tied up. 4-4, everybody. Interstate 70 runs along Indiana, Missouri, and Kansas. In April of May of 1992, it was terrorized by one lone gunman. Six store clerks were shot, each having met their fate over a measly sum of money. Every clerk was a petite brunette except one man who might have confused the killer with his ponytail. In the following 2 years, the same suspected serial murderer would strike Texas with two more kills. Solved or unsolved, the I-70 killer?
I don't know.
Gentlemen, reveal your answers. Kenny says solved. Robert says?
Solved.
Robert
solved.
Says?
Solved.
You both are incorrect. Incorrect. We have never discovered the identity of the I-70 killer. He's still at large to this day. Gentlemen, whoever takes one answer may take the other answer. Kenny, because you wildly disappoint us with your match results, you will be the victim of fate of what Robert... It's all up to Robert, what Robert chooses. Chandra Levy was an American intern at the Federal Bureau of Prisons in Washington, D.C., who disappeared in May of 2001. She was presumed murdered after her skeletal remains were found at Rock Creek Park in 2002. The case attracted attention of the American news media for several years. MPD put much of its focus on the relationship that Levy had, having an affair, of course, with Congressman Gary Condit, a married Democrat serving in his fifth term representing California's 180th district. Was the mystery of the murder of Chandra Levy solved or unsolved?
Solved.
Robert says solved. Let me tally up the results here. Let's get this one and that one and that one. Robert, you, sir, have found yourself in a predicament.
Oh, no.
A new predicament. Kenny, you find yourself in the same one, being in second place. Robert, congratulations.
God damn it. Can't win nothing anymore.
Chandra, the thing about Chandra Levy, that happened just before, what was it, September 11th, and then everybody kind of forgot about it.
Yes.
I mean, like, it was the big thing, and then nobody talked about it. And then that, was it, they caught that kid who did it or something like that.
Yeah, he was assaulting other women in the park and said that he had assaulted her.
Yeah.
They kind of cracked him in, like, 2002. But not before dragging Gary Condit's marriage and career through the mud as hard as they could. He had a pretty good alibi because he was with the Vice President of the United States. But that doesn't count for anything, you know. So what happens, happens. But yes, gentlemen, that is it. Thank you for joining us for Dead or Alive as we have played maybe unsolved mysteries. Thank you very much. And for Kenny, Terry, Robert Wyatt, I'm Tom Nelson, bidding you peace, love, and soul as we head off into the sea of life on the little tugboat that could, the Paracast. Good night, everybody.
Good night, everybody.
Toot toot. Tug tug.
Rub rub.
Love love.
Love you long time.